Hello everyone and welcome back to Curious Apes. You're listening to an archived episode where I do an audiobook type reading of one of my articles called Aggressive Activism and the Neuroscience Behind Why It Fails. Before we get into it, I do want to preface with two quotes that I think are really important to the subject matter that we'll be exploring here. And they're two quotes that I remind myself of often as a way to kind of ground my perspective, especially when I'm engaging with other people. The two quotes are, "Everyone is the hero of their own story." And the second quote is that the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Now, with those two quotes in mind, I want to point out that at this time of radical social and political polarization, it truly seems to be the case that every Twitter persona and every street protester carries with them a self-appointed righteousness that declares that they could fix the world's problems if only the others would get out of the way. They believe this so fully, in fact, that they'll kill over it, whether it's the example of Kyle Rittenhouse killing liberals in Kenosha, or whether it's Michael Reinall killing conservatives in Portland. While most don't go this far, the sense of indignation, the moral superiority, and the hatred that seems to drive this violence seems to truly dominate behavior on both ends of the political spectrum. It's become clear in our modern society that if you're not in 100% agreement with the views of your peer group, you are the enemy. By not conforming, you are labeled as the worst possible epithets that can be slung your way as to declare you worthy of being killed, owned, destroyed, or attacked. For example, if you question the left in any way, shape, or form, even if it's just for clarification, you're labeled as a Nazi fascist, making you somehow equivalent to those who put Jews, homosexuals, and gypsies into ovens, gas chambers, and firing lines. In the same manner, if you question the right at all, if you even suggest that perhaps some forms of racism, sexism, and homophobia are most certainly still permeating our culture and our laws, you're now declared a communist snowflake, making you somehow equivalent to the likes of Stalin and Mao Zedong, who are responsible for at least 35 million deaths. When we think in these simple binary terms, it's no doubt that we break the world into good versus evil, where our team, of course, are the saviors, and any action we take is justified because we are destroying evil. Now, this was a tactic commonly used by actual Nazis, where they consistently referred to Jews as rats and parasites in order to dehumanize them to make it more palatable to kill them. And we are now doing the same thing, referring to those we disagree with as the most heinous evil that we can think of, so we no longer have to consider their humanity, so we don't have to extend any empathy towards them. In such a paradigm, our so-called liberal and Christian ideas of tolerance can be ignored without feeling like we're being hypocritical or like we're acting without virtue. Now, of course, the great irony here is that those who are engaging in this type of behavior are doing so because they actually think it will help make the world a better place. They genuinely believe that by yelling at the other, by making people feel like they're stupid and evil losers who will end up on the wrong side of history, that somehow those others will eventually see the errors of their ways. These people genuinely believe that this hostile approach will change the behavior of the other for the better and sway them into switching sides. And that is the goal, of course, right? You want your movement to grow in size and to have more voices that are added to your cries for change, so that with your power and numbers, you'll ultimately be able to persuade the culture and the government to change in ways that match your vision of a better future. But in all actuality, all this is really doing is having the completely opposite effect. Not only does this aggressive form of activism push people away from your movement, it actually increases the radicalism of the very kind that you're trying to prevent. An increased radicalism worsens the world for everybody. And this isn't me just running my mouth. There's actual good neuroscience to back this up that we can jump into. Now, in the human brain, there are two parts that often work against one another. One side is the amygdala, and one side is the frontal cortex. Now, when one is more active, the other one is usually inhibited or less active. You can think of it like a seesaw. In order for one to go up, the other must come down. Now, the amygdala is one of the oldest parts of our brain, and it's very deeply tied to our sense of survival. Now, as the home of our fight or flight response, it activates most readily when we're scared, stressed, or anxious. And during these states of activation, the amygdala makes us assume and prepare for the worst. And by doing so, it makes us more aggressive and more selfish. Now, working against the amygdala on the other side of the mental seesaw is the newest part of our brain, the frontal cortex. Now, amongst other things, the frontal cortex is largely responsible for acquiring new information, for information processing, and for decision making. It enables things like abstract thought, language, long-term planning, and the organization of ideas. It's also home to the most unique and rare neurons in the animal kingdom, the von Economo neurons, which play a major role in empathy and openness towards others. Now, for our purposes, it's also worth mentioning that it plays a major role in regulating emotions. For instance, it helps to keep us from getting angry when it's not necessary. Now, if you think about it, the seesaw dynamic makes perfect sense from an evolutionary perspective. If you're being threatened by a wild animal, you don't need to keep your anger in check. You don't need empathy. You don't need to worry about language or syntax, and you certainly don't need to worry about long-term planning. If you die, there is no long-term to plan for. And so, when we feel threatened, stressed, or anxious, our brains shut down the unnecessary functions of our frontal cortex as a way to save energy, as a way to conserve brain energy, so that we can focus purely on survival. Unfortunately, the same dynamic is at play for us every day as we attempt to navigate our socio-political conflicts. In fact, any social psychologist will tell you that this dynamic is nearly as strong in social situations as it is against a wild animal. And that's because when we were evolving, being rejected by our peer group meant being cast out and losing the protection of our tribe. And that was just as dangerous as going up against a wild animal. To be alone in the jungle in the early days of our evolution basically meant to die. And so as we accuse each other of being Nazis and communists, as we tell each other we want to destroy them, as we embrace this simple-minded role-playing of good versus evil in the streets and online, all we're really doing is making each other constantly feel threatened, stressed, and anxious. And therefore, all we're really doing is making the other person's amygdala activate and take over and forcing their frontal cortex to basically go offline. So what's this really mean? Well, to start with, it means that we're turning off those empathy neurons, and that's already a really bad start to any form of activism. But perhaps equally important, it means that we're turning off the part of the brain that acquires, processes, and makes sense of new and complex information. In other words, we're making it so that the people that we're attacking are biologically incapable of learning, except in one circumstance. The brain actually makes it so that they can learn fear just fine. And that's because when the frontal cortex shuts down and the amygdala gets more active, the connection between the amygdala and the hippocampus, where our memories are stored, strengthens. What the brain is doing is shutting down our ability to learn and recall anything that isn't fear-related, anything that isn't relevant to survival in that moment. It's our brain's way of saying two things. Check all of our past experiences to see if there's anything useful in this moment that will help us survive. And two, remember everything that is about to happen so that if we find ourselves in a situation like this in the future, we'll know what to do. And because the goal here is to go with what worked in the past, some of the strongest activity in these moments take place in the habitual brain circuits, so that when we're stressed or threatened, our brain is telling us to return to the thoughts and behaviors that are the most comfortable and familiar to us. In other words, do what we know how to do best using the ideas that have provided us safety and acceptance in the past. Now let's say that one more time and really consider what we're trying to say in relation to aggressive activism. When we feel threatened or stressed, we stop learning new information unless it scares us, and instead we become more selfish and aggressively focused on our most comfortable ideas and behaviors. And so by attacking each other in these socio-political conflicts, we're actually making it almost impossible for other people to hear any of the information that we're trying to provide, and instead we're making them more likely to aggressively defend and feel connected to the very thing we're trying to get them to stop believing. Let's look at an example to make this a little bit more tangible. Now, let's say you have a straight white man who was raised in a largely homogenous and conservative culture. He's not overtly racist, he's not overtly sexist, and he's not overtly homophobic. but he has been mostly around a patriarchal white culture with a bunch of people who are straight pretty much his entire life. Now, along comes a movement full of strong women, people of color, and people who are non-conforming in both sexuality and gender. They virtually declare war on everything he knows. Without knowing him personally, they declare him a Nazi fascist who is fragile, toxic, and privileged. They let him know that basically he doesn't deserve anything he's ever earned in his life because of his privilege. Now, this same man, he knows that some of the people who are verbally attacking him in this way are closely tied to people who are physically attacking people in the streets. He knows there's a bit of a civil war going on between these two tribes. And in his mind, whether he likes it or not, the battle lines have already been drawn for him, and he's been forced to be an enemy. Now, with the presence of this threat, his amygdala activates and his frontal cortex begins to quiet. Now he's no longer biologically capable of learning why you might say Black Lives Matter instead of All Lives Matter. And he's no longer able to learn or understand that when you say masculinity is toxic or that you want to smash the patriarchy, you aren't just simply declaring a hatred of men. To think through these things would require complex, nuanced, frontal cortex type thinking where he could abstractly play with ideas and metaphors. But in this case, he can't do that because right now all his biology allows him to do under the threat is retreat into the familiar, into those habitual brain circuits, into selfishness and a strong desire to either fight or flee. And don't forget that in this moment, his brain is also focused on storing memories of this experience so that in future threats, he will instinctively fear these things more. And so his habitual brain circuits in his memory are storing off associations of safe and dangerous. Right now, his mind is storing the ideas of traditional white and straight patriarchal society as safe. And at the same time, his fear centers are wiring together with his memory to help him understand how to navigate threats like this. So now he's associating Black, queer, and female, for example, with danger or with a threat. I know it may sound silly to make it sound this simple, or that he can't just resist these trains of thought, but there's little choice in the matter once you're under threat. Evolution wired him this way in order to keep him alive in the wild and in social situations. So every time he's attacked by this coalition of the left, his brain will strengthen these negative associations, continually seeing his familiar world as safe and in need of defending, and labels like Black, queer, and female as dangerous threats that he needs to fight in order to survive. Now, this is just an example from one side. Of course, the exact same is true when the tables are turned. When white straight men are attacking Black queer females, for example, the hippocampus will be wired to associate white straight men as dangerous and a threat to survival. Knowing that this dynamic is at play in our brain, it shouldn't surprise us that we see these factions speak of the opposing labels as a threat to their civilization's survival. Their brain has literally been reshaped to see things this way. And in their minds, they truly believe the other is trying to destroy them. The point I'm trying to make here is that all we're doing with these overly simplistic and hateful attacks on one another is blocking people from the learning and empathy they need to make true progress. And instead, we're causing them to become more radicalized, more afraid, and more hostile. Instead of creating a place where people can learn from our ideas, can see our humanity, and can potentially change their minds in a way that will allow them to lend their support to our cause, we're forcing people to retreat into and more aggressively champion the very ideas that we want to stop. And as we push people farther and farther away from the middle ground of compromise, respect, and dialogue, where I think all true progress honestly happens, all we're doing is creating more extremists who want to bring down society with their civil war-like hostility towards one another. But imagine if we could embrace the alternative. What if we could instead engage each other with respect and kindness? Then we would be able to use our frontal cortex, right? We'd be able to use that part of our brain that allows us to learn from one another. And then we could use the organizational power of abstract thought and language to plan complex and long-term strategies that will allow everyone to get what they want. We could access those empathy neurons as well. We could learn that, aside from maybe a few contentious issues, all of us basically want the same thing. That there's a lot more that unites us than there is that divides us. And if we unified in this way, we would unlock a feedback loop that would simultaneously calm the culture wars and help us solve the social issues that so many of us are concerned with right now. Let's think about how this could happen, right? If our opposing factions could come together to engage in difficult yet respectful conversations, could actually hear each other and learn from one another, then some compromises could be found. Or at the very least, we would find a way to ignore certain differences for the sake of pragmatic solutions, right? Then we can begin to come up with ideas and approaches that both sides can agree on. And now our numbers really do grow, right? Our movement starts to actually gain traction as we have a shared goal. Now, rather than a nation split in two, we become a unified mass. Then we can turn our attention away from fighting one another, and we can instead bring our fight to the government, to the basically ruling elite, the people who are actually failing us and causing the majority of our problems. With our increased numbers, we can make it so that the politicians have to support the will of the unified masses to get elected. They'll no longer be able to use us versus them demagoguery to distract us while they partake in behaviors that constantly undermine our well-being. In such a scenario, we can actually begin making serious progress on serious issues like our failing education system, our failing healthcare system, and our failing infrastructure. We can start enacting policies that get to the root of why the average American, regardless of political affiliation, is struggling to afford food, rent, and medicine. We can explore why suicide, depression, and anxiety are at the highest levels they've ever been in American history, far surpassing that of the majority of developed countries. And as we address these issues and our quality of life subsequently increases, we'll also see a reduction in things like fear, insecurity, and stress. And, as we already learned, that means less amygdala activation, which means less hostility towards those who are different than us, less selfishness, and more empathy. In a world where we create such a unified improvement of society, our newly safe brains will no longer be so inclined to perceive the other as a constant threat. We will literally become biologically less concerned with people who have different races than us, different sexes, different sexualities, different political parties, whatever. And just as beneficial, we'll be less susceptible to bad actors in our society who seek to weaponize our identities against one another for their ill-gotten gains. Because without the threat of poverty, pain, and stress, we are less likely to retreat into and become defensively attached to our labels. What neuroscience is basically telling us then is that our willingness to engage in difficult conversations with people who are different than us truly changes society in a way that not only improves our lives and the lives of those around us, but it actually removes the biological pressure that is causing the vast majority of issues that divide us, like racism, sexism, and homophobia. Now, to be clear, none of this is to say that if we're kind, we're going to suddenly create a utopia, or that problems wouldn't exist if we would just be nice about it. There are real issues facing both sides of the political spectrum right now, and they are in dire need of being addressed. But the road of hostility and righteousness seems scientifically guaranteed to stop us from ever actually solving those issues. And so the only real alternative left is a willingness to debate and disagree, to risk offending and being offended, and to provide a good faith interpretation of the other. To remember that even in our moments of anger and indignation, that the majority of us, even when someone is doing something shitty, they're doing so from a place that they believe will genuinely make the world a better place. Even in those moments when we feel like someone is saying something truly fucked up and hateful, we must remember that to respond to them in the same manner and to punish those like them for this individual shortcoming is only going to empower our enemy and undermine our ability to grow the movement. So if you actually care about increasing the quality of life for yourself and those around you, the only real option left is to be kind and to be respectful to those people who you disagree with. Only by doing so can you allow people to use their frontal cortex, and only then will they even be physically capable of learning and remembering your ideas. And if your ideas are as good as you think they are, eventually they will find themselves convinced. They'll see our shared humanity, and then together we can fix the systemic issues that are causing so many of us to be shitty to each other in the first place. And why not take this approach? Isn't it worth trying respect rather than just simply watching the world burn?